From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today, an update of news and information from Latin America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua.
Okay, let's just dive right in. We got a whole lot of stuff to cover this week.
Yeah, and on the big event, obviously, over the next week is going to be the Venezuelan election on May 20th.
For sure.
And shortly after that, 1 week later, there's the presidential election in Colombia. Obviously, things in Argentina are not going as well as the government there might like. They've had to go begging to the IMF for assistance, and although they're asking for something, I think they're asking for $25 billion in assistance for the Argentinian economy. They're probably going to need at least double that. And so, and what we were talking about, what you and I were talking about right from the start, ever since Macri won the election back in November 2015, was how long it would take for his policies to come unstuck, and for the Argentinian people to realize that they made a horrendous mistake. And one has to remember, of course, that in that election, Macri only won by, I think it was barely 2%, a very, very tight vote. So it's hardly surprising that the huge sectors of the Argentinian population are now very much up in arms and demonstrating against various of the measures that Mauricio Macri has taken.
Yeah, I mean, he got elected partly because the left, or portions of the left, sat on their hands.
Yeah, sure.
That
has been a huge mistake in various countries in Latin America over the last few years on the part of left wing and progressive political movements. In Chile, for example. And the Sebastian Piñera won again because the left went into left and progressive forces went into the election divided. We're also likely to see the economic policies that Sebastian Piñera is likely to promote will further polarize society in Chile, and within a couple of years, we're likely to see extreme social conflict there, just as we're seeing now in Argentina. So it's interesting to see how take Mexico as an example. And in Mexico, the presidential elections and other elections, municipal elections as well, and I think possibly also the legislature is scheduled for, I think, July. And there, over 100 candidates have been assassinated in the different elections that are scheduled for July. But you never read about that in the international corporate media. What you read about are events here in Nicaragua, events in Venezuela. The economy in Venezuela is always a target for ill-informed comment from the international and corporate media.
Yeah.
And also in Colombia, and you've got a situation where almost every day, barely a day goes by without the murder of some social activist or a former FARC member of the FARC guerrilla movement that made a very difficult decision to go into a peace process with the Colombian government. And now, and as become all too apparent, the fears and suspicions of people who doubted the integrity of the Colombian government's commitment to the peace process and Colombian institutions in general, the courts, the legislature, and so forth. I mean, we were all right because we were all correct to doubt that the Colombian peace process would be implemented as it was signed. And now we're in a situation where I think since January, well over 40, perhaps over 50 social activists across the country, indigenous peoples activists, community leaders of one kind or another, as well as former members of the FARC, guerrilla, have been murdered. And that you've also had in the electoral process in Colombia, there have been death threats against Gustavo Petro, for example, who's the progressive candidate with a real chance of getting into the second round, because in Colombia they have a two-round process whereby the two leading candidates from the first round, if there's no over 50% majority in that first round for the winning candidate, the two leading candidates go to into a second round runoff, and Gustavo Petro is likely to make it to that runoff, and it's by no means clear how things will pan out. The most likely event is that the right wing candidate Iván Duque will win, who's associated with the extreme right wing led by former President Álvaro Uribe. So if Duque wins, you can kiss goodbye to the peace process. I mean, it's very, very difficult to see how the peace process as signed by Juan Manuel Santos, well, getting on for a year and a half ago now, will survive a presidency of somebody like Iván Duque, who's associated with Álvaro Uribe, whose legislative bloc have done everything they can, and his allies in the judiciary, to sabotage the peace process.
Well,
so then, going back to Mexico, and it's very clear that Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the progressive candidate there, is streets ahead of any of the other candidates in the presidential election.
Just so people know, by the way, also, this is a really important election there. It's July 1st. It's the presidential election. It's the national legislative elections, you know, senators and all of that. And it's also the local election in 30 of the 32 states. It's the largest single election in the history of Mexico, it's being called.
Right. And Andrés Manuel López Obrador, he's on something like 40%, and the nearest opposition, sorry, the nearest kind of
competitor,
right wing political candidate, is around 27-28%.
Right.
So, if you go to Brazil, look at Brazil, and Lula da Silva remains in jail on completely baseless charges of corruption. That the prosecution offered zero evidence, that apart from circumstantial evidence, and even that doesn't stand up to any reasonable independent scrutiny. He is also leading the voting intentions. Were he allowed to run, he would win. And so all this stuff about the conservative restoration and all that is complete nonsense in terms of the popular electorate. And you can go back to Argentina. And Macri is now, his levels of support have dropped below 30%. So if an election were held tomorrow between a relatively progressive presidential candidate and a candidate, I think Macri would be allowed to stand for re-election under Argentina's constitution, and the progressive candidate or the social democrat candidate, somebody of that stripe, would easily win against Macri.
Mm-hmm.
So, and in Venezuela, despite everything, despite all that the United States has done to sabotage the Venezuelan economy, to make threats of military intervention, to mobilize countries like Colombia and Brazil and Chile, Peru, all these countries led by right-wing governments, to try and diplomatically isolate and Venezuela, all that has completely failed. And it looks as though, if one can take the most recent opinion polls seriously, Maduro is on something like 50% of, or something over 50%,
right,
in terms of his the likely electoral outcome. Whereas Henry Falcón, the principal right wing candidate, and he's down on around, I think, 30%.
Right.
And the other candidate, a guy called Bertucci, Javier Bertucci, he's a kind of evangelical, his base is the evangelical churches in Venezuela. I think he's on around 16%, 17%, something like that. Now, there again, you have a situation where if the right wing were to unite and put forward a single candidate, which they can't do now, it's too late, but they were talking about it, and they failed to agree. And there the opposition might stand a chance of running Nicolas Maduro's candidacy close. But as things stand, it's very clear that Nicolas Maduro is overwhelmingly likely to win that election in Venezuela, despite everything that the United States and its local allies and countries like Spain in the European Union, and the European Union itself to some extent, have done to try and isolate Venezuela. They completely failed in terms of domestic political support,
right, which is what counts when you're going into an election. But they've pulled all the stops out up here. I was amazed flipping through the channels on cable yesterday. This John Oliver, alleged comedian that has a regular show on HBO, Last Week Tonight, it's called, and goes into I'm flipping channels, and there's this, I don't know, 10, 12 minute long piece. And it's here are the statements in it. Nicolas Maduro is a brutal dictator who is starving the Venezuelan people, and when they complain, he shoots them. That's basically the story.
And maybe we should switch to Venezuela, from Venezuela to Nicaragua.
Yeah.
Because here in Nicaragua, you're getting the same kind of story. I mean, if you read the international media, if you read the right-wing media here, there were peaceful protests that were attacked by the police on April the 18th, which is completely untrue. And ever since then, the government has been shooting peaceful protesters, and it's all the government's fault.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the storyline that you get if you read the international media, and if you read the right-wing media here, and that is the dominant message, of course, across the social media.
Mm.
But what in fact happened was that rival students clashed on April the 18th. The police tried to keep order, and then immediately, from Thursday, April the 19th onwards, right-wing shock groups were using lethal force to attack the police, and they would use the student protests as camouflage. And between Thursday, April 19th, and Monday, April 23rd, and there were something like 20 to 23 deaths in very confused circumstances. Nobody can legitimately say how many protesters were killed, if any peaceful protesters were killed. And what we can say with certainty is that two police were killed, a Sandinista journalist was killed, three or four Sandinista activists were killed, and various innocent bystanders out of those 20 to 23. So then from April 23rd onwards, and then on April 21st, Saturday, April 21st, Sunday, April 22nd, the government withdrew the Social Security forms that were the alleged pretext for these protests. But right. And the, what for any independent observer watching that, looking at that, it was obvious that this was a very well planned soft coup stroke regime change operation.
Right.
And that has continued, because from that weekend, the police very, very pointedly withdrew from doing anything beyond minimum control of public order, especially in Managua. And from that time on, despite constant calls for a peaceful resolution of the conflict, despite an agreement by the main parties concerned, the government, the private business sector organization, the Catholic Church and its right-wing hierarchy, evangelical pastors across the country, all those elements, and even the student leaders, agreed that they would set up a national dialogue, and that was the way to try and resolve the crisis provoked by the initial protests by the students and the subsequent hijacking of those protests by extreme right wingers. Yeah. Now, from that time on, from April 23rd on, the right wing have consistently maintained their attacks against public institutions. They've burnt down municipal offices. They've attacked ordinary motorists. I mean, they and public transport. They're rival groups of right wing taxi drivers and taxi drivers that want dialogue that have clashed in Managua, and there've been attacks on even passengers in taxis. And all that violence comes from the right wing, and they stooped so low at one point that they attacked a bus carrying children with disability from their special school back to their homes.
Oh my God!
And it was it's all very, very similar to what events in Venezuela. Do you remember in Caracas during the protests back last year, and I think it was in June of last year.
And they were stringing wire across the road so that people on motorcycles
they attacked a preschool.
Yeah, that's right.
Too. And it was so. And the right wing violence, which gets zero coverage, in the international media for practical purposes, goes completely under the radar. But the people, people that have been killed in those protests have almost without exception been either bystanders or people just out of curiosity trying to see what's going on, or government activists and Sandinista activists trying to defend the government. And over the weekend, these right-wing gangs burned down the craft market, an internationally famous craft market in a tourist center, a very popular tourist center, Masaya. A Sandinista activist was shot dead during that attack. So, it's just like what happened in Libya, what happened in Syria, what happened in Venezuela, all these attacks against governments that do have a popular majority. And there's no doubt at all that here in Nicaragua, an overwhelming majority of people support the government and the policies that they've implemented over the last 10 years. But what you get in the international media is this downright lie, and they pick it up from local media. Local media put, I was reading in El Nuevo Diario, which is the business sector newspaper here, a completely false set of assertions about what was the timeline since April the 18th, and putting all the blame on the government and zero blame on the violent right-wing opposition gangs that have been responsible for over 90% of the violence.
Have they continued to in Nicaragua? Have the private media there continued to cover the stolen election next door in Honduras? The protests, the wide protests by the opposition.
No, forget it.
And the murder of activists there too, by the government and by the right wing squads.
Yeah, and the fact that, and how many journalists is it now that have been killed since 2016 in Honduras? Is it something like 40?
A lot.
And all the people that have been murdered by the police and the army in Honduras. They're not going to report that. No. And so they build up this completely false picture of events here in Nicaragua. But the reality for them is it's completely relentless that most people in Nicaragua support the government, support President Daniel Ortega and Vice President Rosario Murillo. And the opposition are now desperate to try and maintain the impetus and the momentum of the protests that they hijacked back on in mid-April, but the only way they're able to do that is by alienating people even more, by using the tactic of roadblocks to damage the economy and bring normal life to a halt if they can. And you can do that in Nicaragua. Nicaragua's roads and the main highways are very easy to block. A few hundred people can shut down traffic in Nicaragua very, very effectively because, about 45 kilometers, 50 kilometers south of where I am in Esteli, and there's a fork in the road that goes, one fork goes out to the northern Atlantic coast and the other comes up here to Esteli and then on to the frontier with Honduras and Samoto and Ocotal. And if you block that fork, then and traffic in both directions is completely stopped.
Right.
So, and you don't need many people to do that, especially if the police are deliberately avoiding confrontation.
Right.
And so, and the government strategy seems to be to insist on dialogue, insist on peace, and not provoke confrontation, and let ordinary Nicaraguans see that it's the right wing that are trying to destroy Nicaragua's economy, and that's absolutely clear. There's been a chorus of protests from producers and business people around the country, condemning the right wing roadblocks. So let's see what happens over the next few days.
Right.
But the it's very unlikely that the right wing will be able to maintain support for what they're trying to do, despite what their local media try to project in terms of lying about, it's all the government's fault. When in fact, ever since certainly April 22nd, and it's been the right wing opposition that have been very, very clearly responsible for the overwhelming number of violent incidents that have taken place in Nicaragua since then. So then, and to try and put that in the regional context, and the army here has publicly stated that they are not going to take action against the protesters because that's not their constitutional role. But they support government and they support the peace process and they want the various political actors involved to get into negotiations. Now, if you compare that with anywhere else, and El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, Costa Rica pretends it doesn't have an army, but it has paramilitary forces that are hardly distinguishable from an army. And if the level of violence and the level of economic and social disruption that has taken place in Nicaragua had happened there, you'd have a death toll running into hundreds, because the army would shoot people in those countries. And we've seen that. That's not kind of speculation. We know that's what they do. even against peaceful protests. Genuinely, here in Nicaragua, there have been peaceful protests that have by the opposition and by government supporters that have gone off perfectly calmly, with no repression from the police. And ever since that weekend of 21st and 22nd, the police have taken the position that they are only going to do a minimum to maintain public order, so as to avoid confrontation.
Yes.
And so, but if those peaceful protests had happened in Honduras, we've seen what the police and the army do in Honduras.
Well, yeah.
And if they, against peaceful protesters, so if you then had armed groups murdering police, seriously wounding police, and another incident that happened last week was that right-wing gangs shot and seriously wounded four police who were just on traffic duty. If that happened in Honduras, or in El Salvador, or in Guatemala, and there'd be wholesale massacres of the right-wing gangs, although they wouldn't be right-wing gangs, they'd be
right.
And that's the difference between the, again, in a regional context, the difference between left-wing grassroots activists is that they'll try the electoral route, they'll try the peaceful route, to try and get the political changes that they want. But why? And if you ask, well, why is there so much political violence from the right wing in Nicaragua? It's because they have completely failed to get political power via elections. Right. Election after election, their support is around 30% in total, and they always go into elections divided, and the support for the government has always been over 60% in recent elections.
Yep.
So, and that is why there's all this violence from the right wing in Nicaragua. And you get, and there are two fundamental contradictions, Don. I don't know if you've got time.
You've got about 30 seconds, so go ahead.
Yeah, and the fundamental contradiction is, and are you really going to believe that people like Marco Rubio and Ileana Ros-Lehtinen and their local sympathizers are trying to promote democracy in Nicaragua? And it's just ridiculous.
Or peace, for that matter, or social or economic justice, for that matter, when all you need do is drive around their own districts and the question answers itself. We'll be back with you again later this week and taking a look at the coming election in Venezuela next Sunday and trying to lay things out for people as we go into that. And thank you very much, Tony, for your kind information.
You're very welcome, Don. Look forward to talking to you next time.
Same. Thank you. That's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.